So as we see the events unfolding, especially in the Middle East, it could be creating a higher level of instability. We see that going on globally, nationally, this instability that seems to have come out of nowhere with what we see going on in the Gaza Strip and Israel. It's created a lot of instability, not just nationally or globally, but nationally, but even in cases locally, we've got things going on. I know I get the local school board news, and you know, people are in different places putting up posters to support the terrible things they see. So whatever people may view, it's certainly terrible across the board with what's going on, and you certainly can understand people's emotions with some of the things that are going on. But it can create so all these things can create an instability, even locally and in our own, and feeling what's going on. We see wars in Ukraine has been going on. We haven't forgot about that. So we can have a degree of increased anxiety or an even concern that we may feel. So I think everybody feels that. We watch the news. We see the unrest. And we can even have thoughts ourselves about our own situations. And so, because we certainly understand prophecy. We certainly know there's going to be some challenging times ahead. But we certainly see these situations going on. And we may even begin to think about, how is this going to impact me personally? Or how may this impact our families or loved ones or even our close friends? Some may feel that way. And if so, I would like us today, though, to be encouraged. You know, even though we feel these things, be encouraged by reviewing specifically how God has protected his people in very, very trying times and how God will continue to protect his people. And the title of today's message is simply, God Protects His People. God Protects His People. And the purpose of the message is that we come away from the message encouraged and uplifted with the renewed faith that God does indeed protect his people, those who put their trust and faith in God. King David, who was certainly in very many times precarious situations, difficult situations, from an early age on to later on in age, trusted God. He trusted God in Psalm 25, verses 1, 2, and 3. He says, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. Indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. Let those be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause." So King David in Psalms, and we could survey Psalms that he wrote, has a reoccurring message or theme of trusting in God. You know, he is his shield. He is the one who's going to protect him. He's the one he's looking to protect him, especially in difficult times. At all times, especially when things look kind of dire, he's turning to God and trusting God in those difficult times. So an aspect of the message is for us to trust God in difficult times. Always trust God. Always have faith. God will take care of you. We may not know how. We may not always see the path forward, but God does protect his people. So let's review 7 accounts, and we'll go from Genesis to Revelation of examples of God protecting and caring for his people in difficult times, challenging times. Things were going on around them that were problematic or going to impact his people. And God does take care and watch out for his people. And I hope out of this that we have renewed trust in God for his deliverance and protection at all times. So before we do that, though, let's establish one core foundational truth. And that's found in 2 Timothy 2:19. And that connects all the examples that we're going to go through today. It connects this one theme. This connects everything together. 2 Timothy 2:19. If you want to turn there, you can. If you want to mark up this scripture, you can. If you want to highlight it, you can. It's a very good scripture to think about and consider, and especially in context of the examples that we're going to go through today. So 2 Timothy 2:19, Paul writes, "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. The firm foundation of God stands. That's what Paul writes. The foundation stands because God himself laid it or established it. It's a fundamental truth. And it may be a foundation that may be attacked. However, the foundation that God puts in place or sets in place cannot be removed or broken up or replaced. It's a foundation he puts in place. If God establishes it, then no one else can remove it. And so on this foundation, the solid foundation, is a seal. And we'll talk about seals later on in the sermon. And it's very important that God does use seals, and we'll see this idea again reoccur. But a seal indicates an identifying symbol engraved or stamped into wax or clay to seal a document. If someone was to send a letter, this is going back in the ancient days, if someone was to send a letter or a document, the proof it was indeed from the sender was the personal seal that was pushed into the wax, and this was to show that it was authentic and that the wax seal was unbroken, that no one else had opportunity to alter a document, and it was truly from who was sent it. So the solid or firm foundation that stands has two distinct qualities or statements on the seal. The Lord knows those who are his. Very simple. The Lord knows those who are his. And you might be interested in knowing that Paul is actually quoting or maybe paraphrasing Nahum 1:7. Nahum 1:7, where he says, "The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knows those who trust in him." Again, that's Paul paraphrasing Nahum 1:7. That's where he gets that thought from that he writes to Timothy. God knows or recognizes and cares for those who trust him. And then he goes on and says, and he writes, "Let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." So the other qualifier, you might say, of the seal is that those who name the name of Christ, you got to name the name of Christ, the name of Christ, which means you live by the words and instructions of Christ from God, there's evidence of their belief, in other words. If you name the name of Christ, it means people recognize, well, you're naming the name of Christ, you follow him. You believe unto righteousness, as Paul wrote in Romans 10:10. If you call upon the name of Christ, then you believe, you go on, your heart goes on to righteousness. Something changes. You just can't say you believe or you call the name of Christ, and it has to mean something, and that's what the point is. In 1 John 2, in verses 3, 4, 5, and 6, when we read this last Sabbath, but let me just read it again. It's such a good scripture. 1 John 2, 3 through 6 says, "Now by this we know that we know him." That's what we're talking about. We know him. We know Jesus Christ. You're calling on the name of Christ. It means you know him. How? "If we keep his commandments," he says, John writes, "and he who says, I know him," and that's the whole thing. Do you know Jesus Christ? If you call on the name of Jesus Christ, it means you know him. I mean, you believe him and you trust him and you do what he says. And that's what we're getting to. But he who says, "I know him," and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought to himself also to walk just as he walked. So if you call on the name of Christ, and 1 John, and John's very clear, it means you keep his commandments and you walk as he walked. And in doing so, we get to the part where it says they depart from iniquity or withdraw from wrongdoing and walk as Christ walked. You got to do what Christ says. And we've read this. We read this so many times in this congregation. But let's read it again. I'll read it to you. What Christ said, Jesus Christ said in Matthew 7, 21 and 22 and 23. Because many people say they believe Christ, or they call on his name, but Christ is saying, People may call my name, may say my name even, but what does he say in this verse here? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you, and he's saying you, who practice lawlessness. So you can call the name of Christ all you want. You may even have some things that happen, as they're saying. But if you don't turn from iniquity, you don't do what he says. You can't. So ultimately, if you do what Christ says, you're turning from iniquity. So those who name the name of Christ and depart from wrongdoing is the key. That's the key. And they do not practice lawlessness. So please leave today encouraged. And if only one thing, if you leave with one thing today, leave with this one nugget of truth. The Lord knows those are his. Very encouraging. Does he know you? Well, he knows those are his. And let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. And that foundation with that seal will always stand. So if you just remember one thing from the sermon today, the message, just remember that. That scripture, the Lord knows those who are his. And how are you his? Well, you call on the name of Christ and you depart from iniquity. It means you do what you said. So that one thing, if you just remember that, it'll be a positive outcome. So the seven examples we are going to review demonstrate clearly that God knows those who are his. And those who have turned from iniquity or not participating in iniquity or fighting against iniquity and trying to do things that are righteous or the right things as God outlines in his commandments. So let's go to our first example. We have seven. And as I said, we're going to go from Genesis all the way to Revelation, so in order. Let's go to the very first example we have today is Genesis 6:5 and example of Noah. Example of Noah. So if you want to turn to Genesis 6, verse 5, of God protecting his people. Genesis 6:5 says this, Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. So due to the incredible wickedness on the earth, I mean, that's how bad it was. The whole society is described as having only intent of evil, to continually to do evil. Yet we see this one person, one individual, at least one person in his family, and by extension his family, who has not descended into continually doing evil and wickedness. God sees Noah. He's aware of Noah. He sees Noah. God knows those who are his. Even as this one person, which appears to be only one person, and by extension, his family. Noah, out of all the people. So verse 8 says, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. So this is the first place, as many of you know, this is the first place that the word grace is used. Noah was a righteous man and lived in a habitual fellowship with God. He walked with God, he trusted God, and he was standing on the firm foundation of God's way. All right, verse 11. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So it got so bad that, as you see, people, as values break down, as people begin to just do away with God's law, one of the results of that is violence. And we are seeing certainly an increase in violence across the globe today. As people are moving more and more away from God, more and more further away from his commandments, his values, we see violence. That's the way it was in the day of Noah. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. It's quite a statement. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So again, society had gone so far off course that it had corrupted their ways. And if you're trying to figure out how much time has gone by, just think about 1,500 years. From the time of Adam to about this time, about 1,500 years, 1,500 years has gone by, and they've gotten so far off track. There's no recourse, really. There's no way to fix it. God says he's going to, you know, destroy the whole earth, and except for Noah and his family. They can't reverse what's going on. There's no correction. There's no redeeming values in society. You know, and it's true. Once society gets so entrenched in evil and wrongdoing and wickedness and iniquity and abominations and being incorrigible, it means they can't really turn back. It's just built in, and you can't really recover from it. And the best thing that can happen is what God did, which is destroy the whole earth and begin with Noah, who was a righteous man. So 1,500 years had gone by. That's how bad it had gotten. And it wasn't really something that had devolved so badly. This is what God, into lawlessness, that this is what God's going to do. There's, in a sense, society as a whole, the conscience of the society was seared, as it were, with a hot iron, and it was so desensitized to sin, the results of sin. There's no conscience of wrongdoing. You know, they just didn't even faze them. They did something really, you know, evil, violence, it said, and it just didn't sear. There was no sympathy, no sorrowness, no, oh, I wish that wouldn't have happened. Just seared. And the latter days of society are described that way. So we have a time where it sort of gets to the same point. But for Noah, let's see what God says. You know, we're talking about Noah now. He says, verse 14, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. So God is going to bring Noah out of this event through an ark, and God personally instructs Noah how to make this ark, and Noah obeyed. You know, that kind of showed what kind of person he was. He obeyed God. And making that ark was no small task. Now, anybody who's seen the one, the replica that's down in Kentucky, we've been there, we walked through it, it is big. And it's sort of mind-boggling to think Noah and maybe his family, maybe they had helpers, I don't know, but they made this massive ark, and they were diligent in doing exactly the way God said. Verse 22, thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So again, we see Noah's attitude towards God. He did what God said. He didn't question it. He didn't delay it. He did exactly what God said. He followed his command and made this ark. So we know the events. Noah was diligent. He built the ark to the very exact specs that God gave him. And then he brought the animals onto the ark. And he knew what to bring. He brought a certain amount of unclean, a certain amount of clean animals, and they were all in the ark. And he brought his family, and the animals were all in the ark. Genesis 8:1 says, then God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the animals that were in the ark were with him in the ark, and God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Genesis 9:1 says, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So, you know, God brought them through. They're on the ark, and, you know, they were on the ark based on the way it looks and the way it's accounted for over a year. It rained 40 days, 40 nights. It took away time for the water to be removed, time for the dry land to come up, time for them to be able to get onto the land. But God protected them through all that. He knew Noah. He knew who Noah was. And he protected Noah and his family. God knows those who are his and those who depart from iniquity. So that's the example of Noah. Let's go on to the next example. And this is Lot. Example of Lot. Now, we saw the example of society going so off-track in the time of Noah, but something similar was going to happen in two particular cities during the time of Abraham and the time that Abraham had left his home area and went into the land of Canaan, and there was Sodom and Gomorrah. And those two cities had become so incorrigible, I mean, they just couldn't change, that God decided that he was going to it's better to destroy them than to let them continue on in their wickedness and be so hurtful and harmful and difficult for those around them that he decided to destroy these two cities. And just to keep in mind, though, and you know, in the big picture, the big plan, you know, God is merciful, God is love. What does Jesus say about Sodom and Gomorrah? Are they lost forever? You know, do they have a chance? Well, Jesus said himself, it's going to be more tolerable for those two cities in the judgment than for those who actually heard the teachings of Jesus Christ and the signs and miracles that he did. So these people are not lost. They'll get their opportunity to know God, and that's what's so great about the last great day, you know, that everybody's going to get an opportunity to have a relationship with God. And for some, you know, sort of the way it's presented there, some are going to have given a lot of tolerance. And those who knew better or had more understanding or were there in the days of Jesus Christ, you know, they're going to get a little bit of rebuke. Like, you saw Jesus Christ, you saw the miracles, you saw the signs, you saw the wonder, things he did, and the teachings, and you ignored them. So that's up to God and how he deals with all that, but Christ is pretty clear. It's going to be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah. So I just want to mention that. God is fair, and he's always going to do the right thing, but he doesn't tolerate sin, and there is a point where a society it can't return back, and that's the way Sodom and Gomorrah was. But Abraham had, as you know, a nephew, Lot, and his family lived in Sodom. We recently covered that story a little bit in one of the messages I sent out, you know, where being a peacemaker Abraham and his household, and Lot was part of that household, were all there in the land of Canaan, and they were having wells, and they're doing well, but it's getting a little crowded. And Abraham said, let's not strive. I love that. Let's not strive together. And he said, Lot, just pick what you want, and I'll go the other direction. And so Lot, you can sense, kind of picked the nicer area. And that's where he went. And it kind of goes back to the example I think I used once. You know, it's a very good example. If you're a family, your mother or dad, and you've got more than one kid, and you have one piece of one brownie, you know, you let the person, you let one child cut it in half, and the other one gets to pick which piece he wants first. Well, no, say, in a way, Abraham kind of did that to keep the peace. He let you pick what you want, and whatever you don't pick. But he let Lot cut the brownie and pick the piece he wanted. It's kind of what he did. So Abraham was very generous in that way. But in the end, though, Lot found himself in a very difficult spot as he was near Sodom and Gomorrah, actually in the city, found himself eventually in the city of Sodom. So pick up the story in Genesis 18:20. It says, and the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know. Then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. And Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? So Abraham asks this question. It's a good question because he knows Lot's there. Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all earth do right? You know, this is quite a conversation Abraham's having with, you know, the Lord. But, you know, verse 26, and maybe, you know, the Lord just wanted to see what Abraham was going to do. But verse 26, the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. And as we know the story, it goes from 50 to 40 to 30, 20, even down to 10. And even at 10, God says, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. And we know the story of two angels. They went to Sodom, and they had to get Lot out of there. They took Lot and his family out of Sodom. So let me just recap, though, this. I think Peter puts this in a nice summary way, in a nice context of about Lot. In 2 Peter 2:6 through 8, Peter writes, "And turning the city of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." So, you know, Peter describes this Lot as being tormented and being there, and he's identified as being a righteous individual. And yet God delivers him, gets him out of there. So God is faithful. God is faithful to separate out those who have kept themselves from iniquity. God knows those who are his. All right, let's go on to the next example, Israel and the plagues of Egypt. Israel and the plagues of Egypt. Now, Egypt suffered 10 plagues. But did you know that Israel, the children of Israel living in Goshen, only suffered the first three? I think you probably know that, but just Egypt suffered all 10. And in there is a bit of a lesson, right? As things happen in our society, I think there are going to be things that happen. And we may suffer aspects of that because of the blessings, you might say, that we've experienced in the countries we live in, start to be removed. And some of those blessings being removed, we might experience some of that. But the good news is, Egypt suffered 10, and Israel, or the children of Israel, only 3, because Pharaoh would not let the Israelites go. But let's look at this example. The first three, everybody experienced those. But the fourth example, the flies. And that's found in Exodus 18:20. And let's pick it up in verse 20. I'll read this section here. "And the Lord said to Moses," this is Exodus 8:20, "Rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to the water. Then say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. Or else, if you will not let my people go, I will send swarms of flies on you and your servants, on your people, and into your houses. The houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground on which they stand.'" Verse 22, "And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, and no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign will be." So, you know, I don't know, having all these flies in your house would have been a terrible plague, but the Israelites didn't suffer that plague. Somehow God kept it so no Israelites in the land of Goshen suffered all these swarms of flies in their house. The fifth plague, which is pestilence of the livestock. I won't go through all that, but in Exodus 9, you'll see that the livestock of Egypt died, but the livestock of the children of Israel did not die. Now, the seventh plague, hail. You can see that in Exodus 9. All of Egypt had hail come down, but it says only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. So God made sure that no hail came down on the children of Israel in Goshen. The ninth plague of darkness. For 3 days, it was fully dark. And in Exodus 10, we see this plague. And there was a thick darkness over all of Egypt for 3 days. They could not even see each other, it says. And it said no one even rose from his place for 3 days. So the way I think of this is, have you been in a cave? You know, when you go on these cave tours, and then they're like, "We're done, turn out the lights." And it is pitch dark. Well, that's what it sounds like it was. So dark that you cannot see even your hand in front of you, and all you can do is just stay there, not move, because you don't know anything around you. And this is what it sounds like what happened in Egypt. But it says, "But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings." So I don't know how God did that, but he's God. He can make the grand universe. And we don't even know how many galaxies there are anymore, and billions and trillions of stars. And yet there's this little atom, small thing smaller than an atom, and somehow there's power in an atom. If you pick the right, like uranium, and know how to split it, this little tiny atom All this power's there. Who put that power there? So I don't know. God can do these things, but he put power, he put light in their dwellings. So somehow everywhere there was no light, but they had light in their dwellings. God protected his people. And we certainly know the last plague, you know, the 10th plague, and he had the Israelites put blood on the lintel and the doorpost, the two doorposts, the lamb, the blood of the lamb, and they were passed over. Anybody who didn't have the lamb's blood on their doorpost, the two doorposts and the lintel, the firstborn son would be killed. And that's what happened to the Egyptians and not the Israelites. So again, they were spared. God knows those are his, and he certainly protected the Israelites during these plagues, and he continued to protect them. And we could spend a lot of time on all the protection that God gave the Israelites. But let's go forward now, 1,000 years, about 1,000 years. And this is kind of a sad time in the kingdom of Judah. It might be the last days of the kingdom of Judah, where the temple was in Jerusalem. But we'll go back, we'll go through 1,000 years, because God was going to protect those, as it says, who sighed and cried over the abominations that was going on in the temple. So if you turn to Ezekiel 9, and this is about 1,000 years, you know, from where we just were with Egypt, and Israel has already been taken off the land. That's the northern kingdom because of their not willing to change their ways. And Judah is now in the same spot. It's gotten so bad. They haven't been listening to the prophets. You remember, you got Jeremiah there. You got telling them, and they just ignore Jeremiah. And it gets really bad. But you turn to Ezekiel 9, and here we have a section where God shows Ezekiel the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem and the reasons why. And we'll look at Ezekiel 9, and we'll see something very interesting. Now, if you want to go back to Ezekiel 8, which we're not going to do, God shows Ezekiel what's going on in the temple, the very temple. and he lists three horrible abominations in the very temple going on in there. So Ezekiel 9, verse 3 says, "Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple." So you're sort of having this vision of the glory of the God, which was represented in the temple, leaving. You know, God's glory leaving the temple. Very, very sad when you really think about what that represented. "And he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. And the Lord said to him, 'Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men,'" and I'm assuming this, you know, just not men, but he says the word man, "'who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. And to the others, he said in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eyes spare, nor have any pity.'" So we see God here, he knows, he sees people. The majority are doing the wrong thing, and this is in the temple, the very household of God, built by Solomon, dedicated to God. And again, I won't go through it, but Acts 8 shows the pagan practices going on within the temple. Very sad what they were doing. And God's had enough of it. They're so far off, and he's going to have the temple be destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar, you know, as you know, and the people of that southern kingdom are going to be deported out of there. And many of them suffer difficult times. But he says, but those who are actually in the temple doing these things, those who are sigh and cry about what's going on, he says, put a mark on them, sort of note them. Recognize those who are sad. They're truly sighing and crying of what's going on. And in verse 6, and this is very harsh, but this is what God says, "Utterly slay old and young men, maidens and little children and women, but do not come near anyone on whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary." So they begin with the elders who were before the temple. So we're really talking about elders. People should have known better, right? But the elders, the people that were in the temple, the ones that should have known better, who were not participating in the abominations, God says, mark those people. You know, put a mark on them so, and they're not going to be harmed. It was a very dreadful and sad time in the history of Israel, and really the kingdom of Judah. And God sends an angel of destruction is sent. But God does identify those who have departed from iniquity with a stamp or mark on their foreheads. The implication is that God says, leave these servants alone. They belong to me. Leave them alone. God knows those who are his and those who reject wickedness. So, yet again, another time we see people being protected by God. God knows those who are his, those who are trying to do the right thing, those who are departing from iniquity, those who do not embrace iniquity, who do not, and even cry and sigh and cry for what they're seeing around them. All right, let's go forward again in time to the times of the early church in AD 69 and 70, in that time frame. We just saw the temple. We saw the glory of God leaving the temple that was ultimately destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, if we go 600 years forward again, about that 600 years forward, a little over 600 years, we see the second temple, right? We see the second temple, which was built by Ezra, but enhanced, incredibly enhanced by Herod. So sometimes we call it Herod's temple because he enhanced it quite a bit. And this is the very temple that Jesus Christ walked through, the apostles were in. The Jewish population, however, was regularly, it seems like, motivated to not have a foreign power rule over them. And that was especially true of the Romans. And so about that time, in the mid-60s, there's a really big revolt that comes up in the land of Jerusalem, or around, in Jerusalem around and around that area in the 60s, against the Roman Empire. So remember, in context, what happened to the church? We know we have a church. There's a church in Jerusalem. It's where God started the church in 31 AD. We know that James, the half-brother of Jesus Christ, at one point is a pastor of this church. He's probably most likely not alive at this point in time. But whatever the case, there's a church there. There's people, there's Christians, those that are in his church. The bride of Christ, you might say, is there. He's preparing. Well, let's read what Encyclopedia Britannica says about what is called the first Jewish revolt from 66 AD to 70 AD, just 35 years after Pentecost, when God began to build his church in Jerusalem. So we're doing a little bit of church history here, but I think you'll find it interesting. The Jewish rebellion against the Roman rule in Judea, the first Jewish revolt, was the result of a long series of clashes in which small groups of Jews offered sporadic resistance to the Romans, who in turn responded with severe countermeasures. In the fall of AD 66, the Jews combined in revolt, expelled the Romans from Jerusalem, and overwhelmed in the pass of Beth Horon, a Roman punitive force under Gallus. The imperial legate in Syria, a revolutionary government, was then set up and extended its influence throughout the whole country. Vespasian was dispatched by the Roman Emperor Nero to crush the rebellion. He was joined by Titus, and together the Roman armies entered Galilee, where the historian Josephus, who we know that name, headed the Jewish forces. Josephus' army was confronted by that of Vespasian and fled. After the fall of the fortress of Jotapata, Josephus gave himself up, and the Roman forces swept the country. On the 9th of the month of Av, which is in AD 70, Jerusalem fell, and the temple was burned, and the Jewish state collapsed. So what happened to the church in Jerusalem? Well, the church in Jerusalem would have been familiar with the words that Jesus himself spoke and recorded in Luke 21 and verses 20 through 22, when Jesus says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." So that happened. They understood it. We know that there's likely to have a second fulfillment of that. But let's look at some historical accounts about the church that was there at this time in Jerusalem. So let me quote the history of the primitive church by Jules Le Breton and Jacques Ziller. There's a book they wrote called The History of the Primitive Church. Just means the church in early days. They write, "Before the siege, the Christians left the city by a prophecy which had been revealed to the leaders of the church of Jerusalem. the faithful were admonished to leave the city before the war and to go and live in a town in Perea named Pella. They accordingly withdrew there, and thus the metropolis of the Jews and all the land of Judea was completely abandoned by the saints. And that's from the book History of the Primitive Church by Jules Lebreton and Jacques Ziller. Now, let's build on this. So they left. Let's go now to the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition. Describes these people as obscure, and I think you'll appreciate how this is described, the people that left. An obscure Jewish Christian sect existing at the time of Epiphanius, AD 370, in Col Sierra Decapolis, or Pella, and Byzantis. They dated their settlement in Pella from the time of the flight of the Jewish Christians from Jerusalem immediately before the siege in AD 70. They are characterized neither more nor less than Jew, pure and simple, but adds that they recognized the new covenant as well as the old and believed in the resurrection and in the one God and his son, Jesus Christ. Jerome says they believed in Christ, the Son of God, born of the Virgin Mary, who suffered under Pontius Pilate and rose again, but adds that desiring to be both Jews and Christians, they were neither one nor the other. And this is how the church is described, right? They didn't know how to describe. They're kind of like Jews, but they're kind of like Christians, and as they described them. Now, we're doing a little bit of church history here, just taking a little bit off track here, because I think you'll find something interesting. Acts 24:5. There's a little reference here that you may have overlooked, and we're talking about Paul, right? And this is, I think you'll find this interesting. Just so stick with me on this one because it leads somewhere. For we, in Acts 24:5, Paul, or this is describing of Paul, for we have found this man, talking about Paul here, a plague. And this is these accusers, right? For we found this man a plague. That's how they describe Paul. A creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So Paul here is described as the leader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So they're also described as the one of the way, the Nazarenes. Now, I'm going to go back. Keep that in mind. So he's considered the leader of the Nazarenes. The Nazarenes are simply those, that comes from the term where Christ was raised, Nazareth. So those are that, that's how we got the name Nazarenes. Those who are from this area are really the followers of Christ who lived in Nazarene or Nazareth, and they're called Nazarenes. So the Jewish Encyclopedia says this, though, of this sect, of the Nazarenes, a sect of the primitive Christianity. I just love how they call it primitive Christianity, where later on it gets so much more mature. But the Nazarenes are the sect of the primitive Christianity. It appears to have embraced all those Christians who had been born Jews and who neither would nor could give up the Jewish mode of life. They were probably the descendants of the Judeo-Christians who had fled to Pella before Titus destroyed Jerusalem. Now, I just want to, maybe you've never thought of this. Paul's described as the ringleader of the Nazarenes. Paul, right? Paul, who is the one who supposedly says you don't have to keep the law, and you don't have to do these things. And here he is described by his own people as the sect of the Nazarenes. And the Nazarenes are, by the Jewish Encyclopedia, are described as Christians who really kept what looked like to them Jewish beliefs. Well, the Sabbath and holy days. So just an interesting, just a thought to keep in mind that, you know, Paul, who's always used as the one who's by modern Christianity, that, you know, the law, the Sabbath, those things aren't necessary. Well, here he is as the leader, they're called the ringleader of the Nazarenes, and the Nazarenes were clearly described as those who were have kept what was described as Jewish mode of life, meaning they kept the Sabbath. Was the main thing, and the holy days. All right, but you know, back to the main point. We see the church in Jerusalem was able to flee the destruction of Jerusalem brought on by the Roman armies. God knows those are his and those who forsake lawlessness. All right, so he protected the church in 70 AD. Let's go to the sixth example found in Revelation 7. And this is the ceiling of the 144,000 before the first trump. So we just read something that in Ezekiel, we're going to see something very similar, the ceiling of the 144,000 before the first trump. In Revelation, seven trumpets are blown that represent the cumulative aspect of the day of the Lord and the return of Christ on the seventh trump. But before the first trump is blown, let's read in Revelation 7 something very interesting. Revelation 7, verse 2, 3, and 4, before the first trump is blown. He says, then I saw, and this is John saying what he saw, another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth and the sea or the hills till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. So what do we take note of here? Well, before harm, difficulties, challenges come on the earth and the sea, the servants of God are sealed on their forehead. Now, at the beginning of the message, we talked about seals, the idea of seals, and how it is used to show authenticity of the sender, who they belong to. These servants are sealed before the first trump is blown, and any harm is done. And the church, and this is really, you know, talking about putting a seal on God's servants. So in Revelation 9:4, we see a reference to those sealed within the context of the fifth trumpet. Revelation 9:4 says this, they were commanded not to harm the grass or the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So again, we see this idea of a seal, those being set apart and being spared under the context of the fifth trumpet. Now, let me just pause here. We certainly know that from Revelation 12:11 that there are certainly those who are willing to give their life. They did not love their life till the end. So certainly for a purpose, for a testimony to who God is, there certainly may be those who give their life. But we're seeing, though, that you know, God's servants as a whole being protected and sealed. God knows who are his, and he protects those who are his. All right, let's look at the last example, God protecting his church for three and a half years. Revelation 11, verse 13. This is the last and seventh example I have. It says, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, and this is talking about Satan, he persecuted the woman, and this is talking about the church. The woman symbolizes a woman. The church symbolizes as a woman who gave birth to the male child, but the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So first thing we should notice, the world may not recognize the church, but Satan does. Satan recognizes who the church is and where it is and who's in it. And he attacks her. And it says the woman was given two wings of a great eagle. So they're able to escape. Now, there's been lots of speculation on this. Lots of speculation. But let's just reference Exodus 19, 3 and 4. So let's go back to Exodus. I can read this to you. Exodus 19, verses 3 and 4. It says, thus you shall say to the children of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So Israel, the children of Israel, were brought out of Egypt and it's described as on eagle's wings. But we know they walked. They definitely walked out of Egypt. So the expression indicates an eagle swooping down to grab his prey and fly off with it. That's what it may know. But God certainly plucked out Israel from Egypt and brought it out. I'm going to do a turn there, but just write down Deuteronomy 32, 10 and 11. That's the song of Moses. And Moses in his song, praising God for rescuing the children of Israel out of Egypt. And he talks about God spreading his wings as like an eagle and protecting the children of Israel. And also we have that in Isaiah 40, verse 27 through 31. So if you want that as a reference, you could write that down. So the main thing is that God protects his people. He's these eagle wings, however that's done, there's a way in which God swoops down, in a sense, and protects the church, the woman, as symbolized, a woman which symbolizes the church. And it says that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. So once again, there's been lots of speculation, lots of ideas of what is her place, where her place is. Well, and we know that in Philadelphia, the Church of Philadelphia is told you will be spared, you know, the hour of trial. So whenever God intervenes to deliver his church from the attacking Satan, everyone will know exactly where that place is. So we can be absolutely sure that the bride of Christ will know her place. So wherever that place is, there's been lots of ideas about that, and where that place is, well, the main thing is when it's time to know where that place is, God will certainly make sure the bride of Christ is there, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So once again, we have this 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,260 prophetic days, and this is the end of the age, and it appears to be an actual time, an actual 3.5 years in which she's nourished. In verse 15 says, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. And the Bible talks about, uses the metaphor of a flood as an overwhelming evil or armies. And Satan can send out his armies against God's people. He certainly can do that. But verse 16 says, but the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. So once again, God delivers his people. You know, we see this a future time. He's saving, delivering his people. Moses rejoiced how God opened the earth and swallowed the Egyptians. And you can see that in Exodus 15, 11, 12, and 13, where it says, the earth swallowed them. He says, you stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them. So one way or another, God will handle the problem. That's what I mean. God will handle the problem. And Satan is yet again thwarted. Satan loses again. Especially on it, when they attack God's people, God intervenes. So God knows those who are his. And we have the promise of what we see in Revelation. God knows those who are his and those who reject iniquity. God knows those who are his. So in the message, we reviewed 7 encouraging examples of God's faithful protection of his people from Genesis all the way to the very end of Revelation. We have the promises of Jesus himself saying, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Right? Very strong statement by Jesus Christ. I will build my church. He didn't say he's going to build the largest church, but he says he's going to build his church. And it even says at times it's going to be a small flock. But the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. Very strong statement. We can be very encouraged by that. The called out ones that have the promise of God to the church and the confidence that anyone loves God, this one is known by him. And that's in 1 Corinthians 8:3. Anyone who loves God is known by him. Again, the same message. If you love God, you know God, you abide in his love, he's abiding in you through his spirit, and you know him, you're known by God. The church that has, and this picture is the church that has the exact same faith as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Sometimes they go by names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they had trust in God. They trusted God. God would take care of them. Because they turned from iniquity. They would not disobey God. And they had the commitment to follow God no matter what. And they boldly said to Nebuchadnezzar, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. Don't let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. The same faith that these three men had is the faith and trust that the church will have because they have a relationship with Christ and the Father. So, brethren, I hope you're encouraged fully and completely in faith that the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal. The Lord knows those are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity.